Welcome to the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society. Welcome to ITSP Magazine Podcast Radio. You're about to listen to an episode of Tech Done Different Podcast with Ted Harrington. Do you follow the pack or challenge the status quo? Join Ted as he explores how to succeed by going against conventional wisdom. You'll hear leaders in technology and security tell stories about how they achieve their success by doing things differently. Knowledge is power, now more than ever.
Welcome to another episode of Tech Done Different. I'm your host, Ted Harrington, and with me here today is my very dear friend and fellow security professional, Ben Stanbury. Ben, thank you so much for being on the show.
Great to be here. Thank you, Ted.
So, Ben, by way of, introduction, I'll brag for you, and then you can brag as much as you want. I've known Ben for quite a few years, and Ben currently holds the position of worldwide head of technology at Amazon Studios and has been doing some really interesting things there. And before that, really helped build out quite an impressive security program over at Disney, and then it was EA Sports before that. So Ben knows a thing or two about securing content and digital assets, and so he's going to give us some insights about, we'll see what insights he's going to give us. But Ben, what else should people need to know about your experience? Maybe you can give the 30-second overview of some of the things you've done and experienced.
I think it's going to be a theme of kind of our conversation topics today. I like to kind of address challenges holistically and think big. So a lot of the kind of security and technology challenges that I've picked up over kind of the past decade or so, I've tried to kind of, you know, run the issue down to its, you know, what is the crux? What is the source of the issue? And that kind of led me to, you know, think outside of the confines of the teams, the organizations, or even the companies that I worked with. So I spent a lot of time working with external partners, with industry trade associations, working with competitors or peers across other like-minded companies. And that really got me involved in working with the MPA, the CDSA, TPN, and kind of building a community, participating in a community of people, including yourself, kind of thought leaders in different pockets across this space. And, you know, I think that's definitely an approach that I like to take. It's like, if you possibly can, just think big and see whether you can address these things systemically rather than patch fixing and dealing with, get to the root cause. That's the kind of.
Yeah, I've definitely witnessed that, you know, firsthand at Disney, where the department, the program was, I want to say it was like four people or something in sort of your corner of the world when you started there. And then by the time you moved on, I mean, it was probably 20 plus people. I don't remember exactly what the numbers were, but you'd sort of systematically thought about how to grow the program and grow the way that it delivered value to the organization, both Disney itself, as well as the industry as a whole. How did you do that? I've actually always been really fascinated by the political part of that, right? You had to navigate, there's so much bureaucracy at a large company. How did you navigate that and get all these people aligned to what you're trying to do?
I think traditionally a lot of business leaders, they feel obligated or, you know, obliged to invest in security just from a kind of box ticking perspective. And, you know, you're always going to be confined to just the bare minimum with that approach. So understanding who your stakeholders are, you know, I've used mentor relationships extensively as I kind of tried to understand how to understand, you know, management speak or how to converse in terms that resonate with business leaders. Definitely, that's another kind of little thing. If it doesn't matter what level you are, where you are in your career, if you don't have at least one mentor, I mean, that's the biggest piece of advice I can give to anybody. That doesn't really matter what line of work you're in. Just being able to talk to somebody. Throughout most of my career, I've had at least three different mentors. One within the kind of world that I'm operating, somebody that represents
an attribute that I aspire to kind of get better at or learn more about. And then somebody just gives me a completely different perspective. And I think that's really, really helps balance you out. So, I would say that was kind of the beginnings of the ability to kind of get more senior executive sponsorship to the changes that I was interested in making, was to really understand what the motivators were, what the business language was around these topics, and just opening up conversations. What could I be doing better? What are the things that keep you awake at night? If I have, you know, these big picture ideas, you know, how do I present those to you? How do I get buy-in, support, endorsement to think outside the box? And, you know, once you open up those lines of communication, it definitely changes how you get access to budget and headcount. Because generally the business doesn't, and if you give them security metrics, they don't understand it. It can be overwhelming. You've got to be able to convert that into a real business value proposition. And again, that takes a little bit of priming, because every business stakeholder has different priorities and a different level of familiarity with the work that you're doing.
It's really fascinating, the way you're talking about mentorship. It's a theme that's come up a few times on the show already, but I haven't really heard people talk about it in the way that you describe. You know, we've talked about mentorship in terms of one perspective would be how to level up your own career and develop your own skills, which is part, of course, of what you were talking about. But that's one element. Another element is how people can be mentors to others. But what I'm hearing you say is looking to mentors to be a resource to guide you on how to actually navigate this sort of uncertain and difficult arena. And that's a really interesting way to think about it. It's as much about your own development as it is strategic and tactical. What issues did you run into that? I mean, I guess in a practical sense, how did that work? Like, you just called up some SVP, was like, I'm new guy, I need your help. How did you do it?
Exactly that. I cold called people, and you'd be, I mean, amazed. Now that I'm fortunate in the position that I can kind of give back, and I get those kind of cold calls from time to time. Like, hey, I'm in this role, in this team, in this part of the business, and I just want to kind of have a conversation and get to know a little bit more about what you do and how we can help each other. It's as simple as that. And nobody ever turned me down. I didn't ever have any executive leader say, I'm too busy. They wanted to share their experiences, their learnings, their perspective. And, you know, most good leaders, they also are just inquisitive about you and how can they help somebody that is looking to grow and learn. So yeah, I definitely try and pay that forwards. I try and kind of give the same focus and attention to anybody that approaches me that I was fortunate enough when I reached out to mentors. So yeah, everybody out there listening, if you like I said, if you don't already have mentors, get out there and do it. And, you know, find people to learn from. And if people approach you, like, really kind of invest in that relationship as much as you possibly can, because it can be a real game changer.
It's so fascinating, because I think you're addressing the maybe an unspoken fear that a lot of people have about this topic, right? They're like, oh, that person's so busy. They're so important. Why would they care about me? And I'm new and all these things. And but what I heard you say was a really interesting perspective, which I'm going to interpret what you said. And so tell me if I'm wrong. But you said, you know, that they're these leaders, they're inquisitive. And I'm going to extrapolate from that and tell me if you agree with this or disagree with this. Maybe that's why they're leaders in the first place, is because they're sort of these learners and they're inquisitive. And so by asking these questions of them, you're not, in fact, taking something away from them. You're feeding into something that matters to them and is their skill and is why they're in that position. Would you say that that's true or not?
100%. Yeah. I mean, some of the folk that I reached out to definitely during my time at Disney and outside of the company, I didn't just kind of go through a Rolodex or look on LinkedIn. These were people that had a reputation that I was gravitating towards. And yeah, I think probably all of us in our kind of personal life and our career experience, you see people that are natural leaders, or for one reason or another, it's somebody that you want to you're like, this person just has a knack. They have, how do they do what they do? I mean, their world seems so complex, or they're such a good public speaker. And it's just fascinating what you learn as you get to know some of these, you know, these really high profile executives and leaders. They're just as terrified as you or me with public speaking. Maybe not the grand Ted, who's a natural.
The grand Ted.
But people like me, I'm terrified. Public speaking is just, you know, I get tunnel vision and cold sweats and all of that. And you just assume that these EVPs and presidents of companies are immune to that, but they're not. And they all have their own mechanisms and ways of, you know, prompting themselves to kind of draft heartfelt messages to their staff, how they kind of prioritize work, how they, you know, how they read, what kind of books they read. Just lots of interesting learnings. And you just realize that, actually, do you know what? I can do that too. They're a little, you know, I've got to start small. I'm going to kind of perfect this behavior, or I'm going to wake up every morning and do these two or three things. And there's not as much of a difference between us and those high-flying senior executives as you might think.
Right. They're humans, just like the rest of us.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like that you're talking about the ideas of fear, and even, you know, being vulnerable and talking about, you know, some of your own fear with public speaking stuff. And by the way, I've seen you public speak many times, and maybe you're sweating on the inside, but outside I'm like, that guy's cool as a cucumber. He knows what's up. Practice indeed. So this idea of fear is an interesting one, because I do actually think that a lot of people look at whoever's one, two, three, or more rungs above them, and they're like, oh, that person's got it all figured out. And maybe I'm even intimidated by them because they're so capable or whatever. And what you're saying is that, no, we're all flawed. Well, you didn't necessarily say that, but we all have fears and shortcomings and everything. And that's probably a pretty good thing for people to realize when they're wanting to build relationships, especially at levels maybe above them. Is the recommendation, though, that you lead with that? Or like, what do we do with this knowledge now that we know that senior leaders are fallible and have fear?
Well, one of the ways that I broach this conversation is, which will segue, I think, into the next kind of portion of the conversation, is tech done differently. Not necessarily tech done differently, but definitely my kind of approach to technology problem solving, and this concept of like really thinking big, not just patch fixing, but what is the root cause of this thing, or how can I completely flip this on its head and do it differently? And that, you know, that kind of big picture thinking can be scary. Like, am I going to go to my, you know, can my boss sign off on a $10 million project or whatever it is, or how am I going to get the resources that I need? So sometimes you go to the mentor, you know, I have brokered these kind of mentorship conversations. Like, I've got this challenge, I've got this proposal, I want to just talk through this in technical terms and help understand, you know, the narrative that's going to resonate with other executives. So sometimes you kind of enter into the open up the mentor discussion with a specific topic. Sometimes it's just like, I want to, you know, learn a little bit more about your background, some of the mechanisms and behaviors that you fine-tuned that have helped you be successful. And that's what I was kind of alluding to, just these little shortcuts or these little kind of, you know, secrets that help people kind of climb the career ladder. What is the thing that you need to focus on? What gave you your first break going from individual contributor to a manager, or from manager to senior manager to director? You know, what were the things that you did? Because the worst thing that you can, maybe not the worst thing, I think that if you have the mindset that if I just work hard, career progression will just happen. Somebody will kind of see you at the back of the room and like, that person deserves a promotion. It's not always, unfortunately, it's not always like that. Sometimes you need to kind of be proactive and say, you know, I want to take on more responsibility. I've done this, this, and this. I'm ready for something new. Or even, you know, start to do some of that work. Demonstrate you got the skills, kind of line yourself up for the next career. So I think you've got to be, in many cases, it's really helpful to be proactive and position yourself for that next career development move, lateral or upwards. You know, not everybody wants, you know, career progression can sometimes kind of be linked to managerial experience. And that's not always the right thing for, you know, managing people, you know, especially if you're a technical subject matter expert. Sometimes the management track, it just isn't a good fit. So how do you kind of think about other kind of career development opportunities where that allow you to just kind of focus on the technical subject matter and doing the things that you love to do? And anyway, your line manager or managers around you may not understand how to give you the career progression that you really need. And that's, I've seen that happen a lot, unfortunately, is people want progression just because they want something new, or they want to see that they're kind of getting somewhere with their career, and then they start having direct reports and they realize, like, wow, this isn't for me. I don't like managing people. So you got to, the underlying message there is, you know, the more assertive and more in control of stipulating what you want, what you need, understanding what you need, and articulating that to leaders around you can be beneficial.
Yeah. And maybe that's even hard for people to figure out, is what do they need? Because you're right. It seems like to most people, the only logical progression is exactly as you laid it out: individual contributor, manager, you know, senior manager, and so on. And they're really different skills. I mean, you hear all the time about, you know, someone who's like in sports, someone who's, you know, this amazing, whatever, midfielder, they don't become a great coach necessarily. It's not like the logical progression, even though it feels like it is. They're completely different skills. So I guess it sounds like what you're saying is to, instead of inherently focusing on just going to what that logical next rung is, instead think about what's the logical progression for your areas of interest and your skills. Is that about what you're saying?
Yeah, I think it's all about being proactive. Yeah, understanding how to gather more information, how to get buy-in, sponsorship, kind of learn the additional skills, and don't feel constrained, you know, by the confines of just your immediate team, department, organization. Oftentimes, like I say, opening up a channel of communication with a mentor, or going to your line manager and saying, "Hey, there's this really complex issue. I want to take this on, or I want more responsibility, but I'm not really interested in having direct reports." You know, these are definitely some of the things that I have tried to tackle in my own kind of career progression, or where I have mentored people and trying just giving them the confidence, like, "Yeah, what you're saying is totally reasonable. This is kind of how I've handled similar situations in the past. This is kind of some tips that I would give you going into that conversation." But yeah, it's all about kind of, you know, the empowering people to just go big. Don't feel like you have to just operate. And I see this a lot in technical teams, or just teams in general that I manage or that I work closely with. They feel constrained to just make decisions based on the resources they have available to them. And that's something that is a leap of faith, and it's definitely very scary, is addressing a problem that you know full well that you're not yet fully equipped to do. And you may understand steps one and two, but you definitely don't know further down the line how you're actually going to solve this problem. But you know that it needs to be solved to address this holistically, and you know that you've got smart people around you that are going to help you out. And that's where all of these things we're discussing today is just, like, you know, taking that leap of faith, being brave, making sure that you've got some support around you, either your direct kind of management structure or other sponsors and executives that help you kind of define your narrative. But yeah, that's definitely an approach that I like to take, and I really respect in others that I see, is that even if the road ahead is unsure, that they go for it. They think big. Yeah. They try and tackle that big problem. They try and write that book.
Let's talk about that because I've seen it firsthand over the years. That is exactly what you're not just words. You're not blowing hot air right now. You live what you just said. So let's talk about this idea of approaching technology completely differently. How do you get that project that, like, the $10 million project, as you said, is just sort of a hypothetical, not a real example. But for the people who are listening to a show like this, they probably every single one of them feel that to some extent they face constraints. Maybe there's lack of executive support for what they're trying to do. Maybe there's lack of funding. Maybe they don't have a big enough team, or maybe the wrong people on the team, or maybe they're just by themselves and they're like, hey, this matters. And, you know, they're not getting people to listen. How does one in that situation say, I'm going to do this backward? I'm going to, maybe not backwards, that's not the way I mean to say it, but how does one do this differently and say, well, up is now down, X is now Y. That's how we're going to move forward. What's the advice?
Well, I'm going to speak to just for a brief second about some things. So I'm, as you mentioned, I work at Amazon now, but I'm not representing Amazon in this conversation. I'm just speaking purely about my own personal experiences. But I would say, and this is information that you can get on the internet, you can buy books online. There's one thing that just happens that Amazon has mastered really well, and it's just something that I gravitated to very quickly after, you know, 7 years, nearly 8 years at Disney. Putting your thoughts down on paper. So Amazon has this kind of the business six-pager format that drives business decisions. And I think that it really forces you to crystallize the proposal. And it's something that I would encourage anybody to do, just because some companies have got different mechanisms for how they drive decision-making. Presentation decks with pictures and snippets of information can help get a concept across, but really putting it down in writing from end to end, really defining what your objective is and your general approach, really kind of constructive exercise, because it forces you to really think and rationalize the problem that you're attempting to address, and you just lay it all out there. This is my assessment of the root cause. This is my assessment of kind of a reasonable way of tackling this. And then if you can kind of get data on the economics, you know, by automating this process or by optimizing this activity, what over the long term are the costs or the benefits, whether they're brand integrity or whether they're kind of operational costs. Lay it all out there. Again, this goes back to what we're saying about the mentor relationships and speaking the business language. What are the things that if your marketing organization or if your retail division, if they're presenting a business case and people are going after headcount funding, strategic support, what are they asking for? And if you can get your pitch to look more like a conventional pitch within your organization with all of that well-rounded information, what is your CFO, whoever in the organization is going to be looking at your pitch? You know, if you're thinking big picture, it's going to be those senior executives, which is why the mentor relationships are so helpful, to kind of just make sure that you're talking the right language, that you're using the right terminology, and that you're not presenting a pitch or proposal that has gaps. And I've been in this situation, and maybe I've learned some of these things from my own kind of failures, but it can be really embarrassing being in a room virtually or physically making a pitch and getting answered what in that moment just feels like such a logical question, and you don't have the answer for it. You didn't think it through, or you didn't come with in the appendix a little kind of table with some stats. Understanding what questioning, you know, the rigor around the questions and producing a well-rounded pitch. That's the, you know, that's, it's such a healthy exercise. And even if you don't get your proposal endorsed, you've just had a chance to sit in front of some senior folk and they've seen your mental process and your rigor and your work ethic and your writing style, which can be helpful to kind of, you know, most of us haven't written a lot since school or college, and actually it's a really helpful business tool if you do it right. So yeah, that's my advice, is you've got to do your homework. It's just, the idea itself is great, but you need to flesh it out and you need to get it proofread and you need to get those inputs from your peers, other experts. But ideally, how are the executives that they're going to sign off on this, how are they interpreting the information that you're putting in front of them, and what questions are they going to ask? And forewarned is forearmed.
Wow, there's so many interesting insights woven into what you just said. So let me spit some of them back to you and tell me, and maybe let's talk about some of these different elements. So some of the things I heard you say were, number one, it sounds like know your audience, know what they're looking for, know how to speak their language. The second thing I think that I heard you say was because of, and I'm interpreting this based on the sort of 6-page concept, that brevity is important. So be able to make your point and make it quickly. And then it sounds like the third key takeaway was to be really clear and precise, like set your objective, set how you're going to do it, set how you're going to measure it. And then it sounds like if you do those three things, one of the other things I heard you say was that even if the project doesn't succeed, you wind up getting a benefit because you now just had this dog and pony show in front of these executives and they're like, wow, that's a smart person. Does that sound like a right way of organizing what you just described?
100% right. And that's, you know, that is the, those, these are some of the, you know, the shortcuts to career development in my mind, both, you know, firsthand experience and now, you know, being in the chance of being, you know, being in the position of being the executive reviewer. Now, I always am looking at the pitch with both of those lenses. Is this a good idea? Is this something we should be investing in? And I'm looking at the individual or the team that have come with this pitch. I'm like, all right, how well did they think this through? Did they do their homework? Did they take the time to spell check and grammar check? Do they understand the customer? Do they understand the problem? Are they showing a concise kind of strategic pitch? And this is something, by the way, that is an ongoing, never-ending skill. You know, I have to write these materials. I produce these pitches, and it's tough. There's a lot of late nights and weekends. Nobody's saying that any of this is easy, but you know that is definitely what it takes to differentiate yourself, differentiate your, even if you're in the perfect spot career-wise and you just love what you do, you don't really want to do anything else, but getting your ideas out there. And you know, so many of us, either, you know, in the past or now, we're like, we feel like we could do so much more if we had more money. And I've had so many different examples where, you know, the higher up the executive ladder you get, obviously the economics change a lot. And it's as strange as it sounds, it can be easier sometimes getting approval for $1 million or $10 million than it is getting approval for $75 to buy this software license. You get into a different realm with different strategic considerations. And if you, again, if you resonate, if your pitch resonates, it's amazing what doors it can unlock. And you'd be really surprised that if you educate, because information gets filtered and redacted and almost unrecognizable from its source. By the time senior execs are reading information about your program or what you're doing, they may be getting a bullet point or a paragraph. They don't really understand everything, all of the challenges and issues that are going on at the ground level, unless you've got really, really good kind of management reporting, which just is not generally done as well as it should be. So, you know, oftentimes that kind of a light bulb moment, that aha, like, wow, okay, we're not doing this. I agree with you. This is an issue. We as a company, or we as a division, we shouldn't have this problem going on. We shouldn't be spending this many cycles on this task, that if we did invested in X now, we could automate this, or we can modify the process to make it more, you know, increase the integrity of the data, or the better internal customer experience or an external customer experience. But yeah, that opportunity to like just lay it out there, you'd be surprised at how much kind of backing you can get if it's an idea that resonates. So yeah.
So I'm really interested to put myself in the shoes of those people that you are pitching ideas to. And I think many of the listeners of this show will also be interested. So there's sort of, I guess, two angles I want to go down on this. So we'll pick one, and if we come back to the other one, great. The first is, I'm curious to, from your experience, how you think those decisions are made. And to, I guess maybe that's a really broad question. So to put a little bit of maybe a box around it, there's sort of, as I understand it, there's sort of three ways that humans make decisions. We make decisions emotionally, we make decisions based on logic, and we make decisions based on data. So, and obviously any decision has a combination of those two and maybe skews towards one more than the other. But in your experience, in your opinion, of those sort of three categories, and there may be more, but use that as a starting point. How do you think these decisions are largely made?
I would say as a, you know, something interesting, I've kind of reflected, something's interesting happened with my career at a certain point, and I'm not really sure exactly when it happened, but I'm not really a technologist anymore. I'm not really a security expert anymore. What I'm basically, what you become at a certain point is you're running a business. So in my role, you know, I have a P&L, I've got employees, I've got, you know, just all the economics and customer forces at play. So, you know, that is a lot of what your executives, the way that they're weighing up the pros and cons, you know, that they are, you know, a business within a business, maybe even within another business. And, you know, what is this? Does this increase profitability? And does this improve the brand? Does it address a risk that could have impact to the board? So it really depends on the pitch. But, you know, there is definitely a portion of the leader's mind that is thinking about the pure, you know, math and economics of the pitch. There's another one that's thinking like, is that we are, yeah, again, it kind of really, really varies by, you know, case to case. But it is definitely, I think it's interesting, though I was reflecting on this recently, that you kind of become at a certain point, if you're running a team, you have to think of yourself as a small business owner. And you're making decisions about what's in the best interest of your workforce, what's in the best interest of your customer, what makes you kind of financially, whether it's real dollars and cents or just kind of just, you know, the budget. That's often why I find automation and process deduplication are really topics that resonate. And if you can frame your pitch around issues that that are going to resonate with the business, because that's definitely something I always try and reflect in my proposals, is by executing this change, by investing in this change, yes, it's potentially a large amount of dollars and cents, but this is going to mean that next year your incremental headcount growth is going to either stay flat, or, you know, we're going to be able to support international expansion without the need for in-territory headcount in this particular area. Can optimize the resource hours of your senior staff because they're not having to go and find data, or they don't have to log into 10 different applications to do X, Y, or Z. So those are, you know, going back to your comment, understand your audience. What are the things that immediately get their attention? I've definitely pitched proposals to senior execs where I've seen their eyes rolling back and they're drifting off to sleep because they're not really connecting, or, you know, they're not really interested in what I'm telling them, even though it was like full of data and I'd done all my homework and it was good security subject matter, but, you know, they don't really care about that. And this is, well, sorry, that's the wrong way to phrase it. They definitely care about it. But if you're asking for more money, you know, why does your proposal stand out more than something from another department where there's a financial return on that investment? So.
Right. The second angle that I wanted to ask about was something that's come up a few times, which is jargon. One of the things that I've definitely observed, especially in large enterprises like where you currently work and have worked, it seems like the larger the enterprise, the more deep into jargon most people are. And I'm curious to your opinion of when you're making these pitches and trying to really persuade these influential leaders to part with money or person, power, resources, or whatever resource you're asking for in order to do something. it seems like the conversations tend to skew towards using a lot of buzzwords and jargon, but is that because that's just what people default to, or is there a better way? Like, is simple, more clear speaking, in fact, more effective?
Absolutely the latter. Definitely clear speaking by a country mile. I mean, and this is actually why I think the doc, laying out your proposal in a document rather than a series of subjective slides or a verbal pitch. Because, yeah, there's common acronyms that people tend to use. And, yeah, you may inadvertently be alienating somebody that doesn't understand the jargon. So it's a great thing about putting things in a document and the rigor that comes with conventional structure to your document. The first time you introduce a term, you define it. Or you introduce a footnote that explains what this thing is. And it's a really good way of ensuring that everybody in that room is making a decision on the same data. There's nothing to be interpreted. You've spelled it all out. You know, you've used your whatever rigor you've decided with the document, and you've laid out all the facts. And it's just a great way of ensuring that, as I said, that the final decision is being made with everybody on the same page. There's no kind of disparity in your decision makers. So it's a incredibly efficient way of driving results, of driving kind of consensus decision making. But it means more homework up front. But that's not a bad thing, as we said. There's even if your proposal doesn't get accepted, you've still demonstrated that you're methodical, you're thoughtful, right, you understand the subject matter, and you understand your audience.
Yeah, I've certainly found, you know, from the process of writing a book, how hard it is to speak simply. Like when I look at my book, the glossary is like, it's like 5 or 6 pages long of just terms. It's just like defining terms so that I can then tell you what to do with this information. And so that's often difficult for people, is how do you say something simply? And so that was really refreshing to hear you say that, even as you're talking about these conversations at the highest levels in some of the largest companies, that people still want just say it frankly, right? Say it simply and help me understand why I want to do this thing. And I think that's a really powerful takeaway for the audience.
Especially when you're speaking when you're speaking outside of the confines of your organization, don't expect them to understand anything about what you do. So you need to find that common language, and it generally means going back to basics and just describing what this thing is.
Yeah. So let's talk about if there's an example that you can mention where either something that you're really proud of that succeeded, or maybe something that did the opposite that failed, that was this core idea of thinking differently, going against the conventional wisdom. You've certainly been involved in some really big technology initiatives. I mean, as you said, now you're sort of growing away from actually doing the initiatives themselves. You're more approving the initiatives now. But what are some examples of something you've been involved with, you've been really proud of, that you said, hey, everyone was approaching it in this one way, and we said, let's do it this other way. And what happened?
Well, that's a good question. I haven't prepared for this. Let me try and think. There's a few initiatives that I've kind of, or some concepts that I've leveraged in my kind of technology and security roles. And, you know, mechanisms that provide a good communication channels to the business or to, you know, to the stakeholders. So at Disney, myself and my team stood up a program called Content Security Guardians. And it's some of the learnings from that have informed other industry programs that I've participated in and my current role. And, you know, it's definitely, even though it's a challenging kind of concept, just the desire to be interconnected and communicating regularly and efficiently with the teams that I support, the customers, the stakeholders, definitely is an exercise that's constantly being refined, but something I'm really vested in and I really believe in. I think the worst situation you can be in with any kind of security or technology role is just not
not speaking the same language, not having a relationship with the people that you're trying to protect or the people that you're trying to support or the people that are funding you. So, you know, that the Guardians program for me represented more than kind of the pros and cons of the actual execution, just this intent and desire to be connected to teams outside of, you know, whether it was the productions, whether it was visual effects departments, whether it was marketing, so on and so forth. Like, let's just get out. Let's invest the time in having dialogue and preparing materials that we think that these communities are going to digest, are going to appreciate. And I think that's a, you know, I think just broadly speaking, that whole idea of building mechanisms and getting feedback, even if, you know, oftentimes, well, soliciting feedback can be tough because you're asking a question, you're preparing yourself to get some positive feedback, and then you get something that kind of takes the wind out of your sails, and you're like, oh man, okay, things are not perfect, and the customer isn't like perfectly happy. But what you start to realize is by soliciting feedback and having that open channel of communication, it's a gift. If somebody's willing to be honest with you and tell you that you could be doing, you know, you're doing this thing great, but this kind of sucks, that is a gift. You've got to embrace that somebody was willing to kind of share that information with you. And that's the best thing you could possibly do to refine your approach and deliver a better service to your customer or your stakeholder. So, these principles and learnings from that approach are things that I really actively try and spend some time every single day, and every single thing that I do is like, who is my customer? Who are my stakeholders? What do they want? Are the services that I'm delivering, are they successful? Are there things we could be doing better? Is there something we've completely missed that they wish that we were doing? Even if it's just dialogue where I provide rationale or an explanation as to why this thing, it's like, yeah, I'd love to be able to do these extra things, but I don't have the headcount, I don't have the resources, or so-and-so is on vacation, or just the conversation. And generally, you can diffuse these little frustrations or kind of get ideas to build upon and improve the service. But you've got to have that kind of, you've got to build that trust, you've got to have that channel of dialogue, and you've got to have that communication flow going both ways. So, like I said, it's not one particular program or initiative, but the concept there of being out there engaged with the business at all levels is an endeavor that I continue to work on, but it's incredibly rewarding and it's necessary.
Sure. That's such a good story to wrap up on here as we come to the end of our time, because what I'm hearing you describe in this one example, in this one story you're just talking about, in so many ways summarizes a lot of all the advice that you gave today, which was build relationships. And to me, in the context of a show that's about how do we do technology different, that to me actually really sounds different, because I think most people think about how do we approach technology and how do we approach security. It's often thought of as very scientific, very technical, and in fact, very distrusting by nature. I mean, at least the security profile, we're a paranoid bunch and we don't want to trust anybody. But what I'm hearing you say is to make sure that you build relationships above on your peer level and below as well, across the industry, make sure who you're talking to, make sure you understand what they care about, how you communicate with them. Those are really powerful takeaways, and I think that will really help people do and think differently. So that's great, man.
Great.
Cool. Well, as we wrap up, I guess what's next? You know, if you pull out your crystal ball, what do you see is coming around the corner for just technologists, or where technology's going, or where security's going, or where enterprise are going? Answer that however you want, but whatever you think you have a view on.
I think that there's a ton of learnings, you know, as the pandemic, you know, knock on wood, hopefully with the vaccines rolling out and we start to kind of hopefully, you know, work our way out of this, you know, the impacts of COVID and how it's changed our lives, how it's changed our businesses, And, you know, heaven forbid, you know, something like this happens again. We've definitely experienced triggers for moving, virtualizing more workflows, being more location independent. So, you know, I think that, you know, this the pandemic has accelerated adoption of, you know, we're on Zoom right now, and I don't think I'd ever heard of Zoom before COVID. Maybe I had. But, you know, definitely there are a number of little things that have changed that have accelerated adoption of cloud-based solutions and workflows, and are forcing companies and individuals to reevaluate. Do I really need to be in the office? Do I need to install this piece of software on this machine? What I think is coming next, I think, you know, some transformations, small, medium, and large, and yeah, more virtualization, more driving reinvention of kind of technology platforms. So I think we're going to see, yeah, just more global expansion, and how, you know, how technology, the kind of the current generation or emerging generation of technology solutions are going to support that. So I think it's fascinating to see how that unfolds.
Awesome, man. I love it. Well, thank you so much, Ben, for being on the show. I personally learned out of this. These are questions that I wanted to know the answer to. So thank you for that. I think our audience will really appreciate it. And thanks for your time today. And for everyone else, you know, make sure you stay tuned at tedharrington.com/podcast, where we'll make sure we're posting Ben's episode and many more to come. So, Ben, thank you for your time.
Thank you. That was fun. Thanks, Ben. Thanks, everybody.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Tech Done Different podcast with Ted Harrington. If you learned something new and this conversation made you think, then share ITSPmagazine.com with your friends, family, and colleagues. If you represent a company and wish to associate your brand with our conversations, sponsor one or more of our podcast channels. We hope you will come back for more stories and follow us on our journey. You can always find us at the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society.